This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to beat Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we are going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
So today, we're going to look at why a DOJ lawsuit versus Google/Alphabet is unlikely to change the tech company's near to medium term fundamentals.
Plus, we'll delve into why Barstool Sports could yield a 45% return on investment for Penn by 2023.
Oh, Paul and your sports. All right, yes. First, something that we're all thinking about, the U.S. election. Joining us now to talk about 2020 election fears, the impact on stocks, is Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist Gina Martin Adams. Gina, I don't envy your job, having to understand what the positioning is like, etc. But let's start with maybe sectors that are already pricing in maybe either a blue wave, a light blue wave, or a Biden presidency.
Good question. Million-dollar question, really. I think that, in general, my best guess is that the market is pricing for Biden, not a full blue wave. And the reason I say that is because the only sector where we do think a blue wave looks to be priced is probably healthcare. Healthcare has shown tremendous sensitivity to the movements in policy, both the addition of new Supreme Court justice in the last week, as well as anticipation of potential policy reform into 2021, seems to be plaguing healthcare. But the rest of the market seems to anticipate maybe a fiscal policy package into 2021, more than likely a Joe Biden presidency, and probably some chatter around tax reform, but not any full tax. So I think it's on the middle that the market is pricing. So you could have a surprise if you had a blue wave or if you had a Trump win.
It sounds like it's almost scenario analysis, Gina. You know, one scenario is a Biden Republican Senate, one is Biden Democrat Senate, one is Trump and Republicans. It's almost like you have to game out a number of scenarios.
Yeah, you do, because it's highly unlikely you get a tremendous amount of policy activity if you have a Biden presidency, but the Senate is still majority Republican. You know, you're unlikely to have a significant change to healthcare policy in that sort of division of power. You're also unlikely to have major tax reform in that division of power. However, if you have a Biden presidency with a blue wave, then you do have the prospect for some pretty significant policy change. It doesn't seem to me that, given where the market is, which is basically it's just been stalled near highs since late August, early September, that kind of price activity wouldn't suggest a market that's starting to price in major change to taxes. And that said, the healthcare sector is trading at its lowest multiples, despite the fact that we're in a pandemic, despite the fact that earnings for that sector are much faster than the rest of the index, and revenues are expected to maintain a pretty solid pace into 2021. So I think the healthcare sector is maybe telling you a little bit something different than what the broad market is. So you definitely want to be on guard for what happens on election night, because we very well could have something of a spike in volatility if the base case scenario doesn't come true.
So if that's the case for healthcare, I mean, you can make an argument that it would be the same for tech?
Well,
or should you, I guess?
Necessarily, yeah. Tech doesn't necessarily undergo the massive potential policy change. I mean, healthcare is thinking about things like prescription drug pricing changing, Medicare plans changing. Tech has a potential regulatory outlook shift that is on the horizon, but is much more difficult to game. The legislators can obviously really directly and very quickly have a strong impact on healthcare. The thing that healthcare and tech have in common is tax reform, and this idea that under a blue wave, a portion of tax reform will likely be dedicated to trying to figure out ways to tax those multinational revenues, cash held overseas, inversions, and the like. And on that, then tech and healthcare do have the common sort of concern over what tax will look like.
So, Gina, what it's interesting here. It's is it expected? Do you think the markets are expecting if Biden were to win, that the tax cuts initiated by President Trump would be unwound to a certain degree? Is that the working expectation?
Yeah, the working expectation is that Biden's proposed tax reform plan would basically take corporate tax rates halfway back to where they were before Trump took office and enacted the 2017 tax reform. So we would have a statutory corporate tax rate at 28%, certainly higher than the 21% that it's at currently, but not as high as the 35% it was at back in 2017. But then there are a lot of more detailed nuances in the corporate tax reform package as well.
There are always nuances in corporate taxes. Come on.
Exactly. One of them is certainly multinational revenues. The other thing that we've been watching really carefully, separate and distinct from corporate tax reform, is capital gains tax reform. Mm-hmm. The Biden plan proposes taking the capital gains tax rate to a new all-time high. And if that's the case, that could have some pretty significant impacts on the market. I mean, that'll have immediate impacts potentially because you'll have investors potentially trying to gain taxes through tax loss selling this year in anticipation of an increase in capital gains taxes next year. So we could have some pretty significant volatility if we do indeed get a blue wave and the market has to start thinking about pricing in a pretty different tax environment into the near-term future.
Man, okay. I'm glad I don't have your job, Gina. Thank you. Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist Gina Martin Adams.
Coming up on the program, staying on the race for the White House, a look at the impact of the election volatility on U.S. options.
Now here's what's going to get fun. You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on your terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, our next guest writes that U.S. options and cash equities activity may see a fourth quarter tailwind as U.S. elections drive greater volatility. For more, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Paul Goldberg. So, Paul, give us your thesis behind this. I know you're looking at it from the angles of the exchanges, but if there is more volatility, that's good for the exchanges?
Yes, Paul. Thank you for having me. It's absolutely good for the exchanges. It doesn't matter whether it's good volatility or bad volatility. It's more activity for the exchanges. People hedge their positions ahead of the elections and into the elections. People adjust their portfolios, mutual funds, hedge funds, depending on which administration takes place.
Does it stop? Like, is it like, oh, here's the winner, bye, and then it like ends?
Well, that's a bit of an interesting twist because usually it stops fairly quickly. So the election's on November 3rd this year, and usually people would adjust their position by the early next year. But given the situation right now with the COVID being an underlying issue and a lot of more issues about contested elections and things like that, that may very well go into the next year.
So are the exchanges, are they prepared for this volatility, this potential volume?
They absolutely are. So the exchanges are set up to handle a lot more volume, several times the volume they're already handling in terms of their service and in terms of their technology. That's very easily handled. And just to give you an example, the volatility spiked to a big spike to almost 80 earlier in the year,
yeah,
after COVID, and the exchanges went just fine. There were no hiccups at all.
So then how do they, this is a really dumb question, how do they make money off of this? Like, to not only maybe gain market share, but just to be able to capitalize on the increased activity?
The fees. The fees. Every trade has a commission fee attached to it, so they collect commissions. Kind of riskless business for them. The more activity, the more they earn.
So, Paul, what are some of the exchanges out there? Because, you know, I started out in this business. I actually did spend some time on the New York Stock Exchange floor, actually, during the October 87 crash, which was...
I was going to say, Paul, that was like in the 20s, man.
That was a story in and of itself. but they're not even really... Talk to us about the whole exchange environment. What are they? Is it just some computer sitting somewhere in New Jersey? And kind of what are the exchanges? Where are they? And kind of what are the ones that could benefit from this trend?
Well, the three biggest players right now are New York Stock Exchange and NY, their owner, ICE, Intercontinental Exchange, that owns several exchanges. And they own actually cash equities and options, and very similar story for NASDAQ that owns both exchanges on the options and equity space, and CBOE. So these are the three biggest players. There are smaller players, IEX, they have roughly 3% market share, and there are three new entrants, actually, in the last several months, but none of them really gained much of a market share yet. And on top of that, about 40%, actually more than 40% these days, of volume goes through the dark pools, the pools that are usually crossed by brokers and then reported onto the tape.
Is there a distinction between options trading and equities? Like who win, like what's being traded the most right now, aka then who wins the most?
Options probably the most used instrument right now, because it's much easier to adjust positions. It's less expensive than going into the equity outright. The biggest players are NASDAQ and Cboe in terms of their options volumes. And the options right now are up about 40% for October versus October of last year. So we do have a very active base even before the elections.
So, Paul, are these national exchanges or are they global exchanges?
Well, these businesses in particular, they're U.S. U.S. businesses, but really all the exchanges, they're global. So NASDAQ has business in the Nordics. Cboe has big European presence in the equities markets. And ICE, they don't trade any equities or options in Europe in particular in the equity space, but they're one of the biggest energy players out of Europe.
So which one of these are going to get the biggest boost to earnings growth, and sort of how long is that spread out for?
Well, if I had to rank them, for the best probably would be NASDAQ and Cboe because of their smaller size. And even though ICE would and NYC would get roughly the same gain in terms of the revenue, additional revenue, just because they're much bigger proportionally, boost is going to be a little bit smaller for them. And as I said, it can last into December or it can last very well through the first quarter of next year.
Paul, how do investors typically play, you know, increases in volatility and volumes on exchanges?
I mean, you can definitely play it by directly investing into the exchanges. And some of them had some pressure this year because of certain issues and were sold off. But from the typical investor, a hedge fund or a mutual fund, they can use options to hedge their positions. They can use options to make bets on volatility, whether the volatility is spiking or volatility not moving. So there are plenty of instruments in the derivative space that can very easily allow them to play those positions. And the ETFs, obviously. ETFs is a very cost-effective instrument.
How do the exchanges get more clients? Do they compete? You mentioned ETFs. Do they compete on fees? Like, how do they get more market share from each other?
To be honest, the market share among those three players have been pretty static. Hmm. It hasn't moved very dramatically. The fees have been compressed over that long period that Paul alluded to before. So the fees, you're talking about are five basis points on 100 shares, so the fees are very low. It's really a volume business. Mm-hmm. They do compete. They usually compete in terms of trying to provide the products, trying to provide analytic products, market data. So most of the competition really happens outside of the actual trade execution.
Oh, interesting.
So, Paul, I'm looking at the year-to-date stock performances, and I see the Cboe at minus 30-some-odd percent, CME at minus nearly 20%, yet NASDAQ is up 18 or so, Intercontinental is up about 6%. What's the differential there? Is it the products they trade, ones maybe options-oriented versus stock-oriented?
Yes, it is really the product mix. NASDAQ has been obviously a beneficial of the whole COVID and retail movement this year because there are a lot more players from retail side,
the Robin Hood effect.
Markets, and NASDAQ also trades all the technology names, right? And these have been the winners this year. So that's why they done really well.
Well, that's our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst Paul Goldberg. We appreciate your thoughts there on the exchange business.
All right, well, coming up on the program, we're going to get some reaction to the report that the DOJ lawsuit against Alphabet is unlikely to change fundamentals.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BIGO on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Our next analyst writes that although scrutiny may increase in Alphabet's core search and advertising business, its near to medium term fundamentals are unlikely to change amid a DOJ lawsuit. Here to break it down, Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Mandeep Singh. Okay, Mandeep, let's refresh the audience here. What is the DOJ lawsuit?
Well, so the lawsuit is really around the antitrust and the monopolistic behavior of Google's core search business and how they have over 90% market share. And I think it really brings to the fore how Google has built this business and why there is no competition. So we've seen, you know, all different sorts of businesses complaining about, especially in the search arena, complaining about how Google doesn't allow competitors to really, it's not a level playing field in that sense. And it's nothing new. I think the fact that, you know, we had so many U.S. states file the lawsuit at the same time kind of makes it a bigger deal. But when we look at the fundamentals of the business and, you know, the moat that Google has around its business, we think they will probably have to make some modifications to their kind of how they capture data. And they've already been doing that. But fundamentally, it doesn't change the fact that Google has such a big lead when it comes to search and all the assets that they have, both on the mobile and, you know, the online video side, that it will be hard for anybody to, you know, compete with them, at least in the near to medium term.
Ergo, the problem for some people.
Ergo, you're whipping out all these formal words today.
Exactly. too much time in home quarantine, I think. So Mandeep, it's interesting that, you know, they really have created this extraordinary competitive moat in search. They're huge with YouTube on the video side of the business. You know, has the company offered up any kind of, you know, an indication that they're willing to work with the regulators or with Congress, or do they just feel so secure in their case that they're just going to kind of see this through?
Well, so they have always kind of maintained this kind of rhetoric around how they, you know, are willing to work with the regulators. But at the end of the day, you know, the fact that search is free, and, you know, online, YouTube, it's a freemium model. And, you know, how they monetize it is really through ads. But they still have a very sticky monthly subscriber base. There are other competitors in online video. And, you know, Google never really made it that big on the social media side. So their plea has been that when you look at the overall ad market, Google doesn't have over a 90% share simply because on the social media front, Facebook has the majority share, followed by, you know, smaller players like Twitter and Snap. So they've been trying to make their case that, you know, it should be really looked as the overall advertising pie as opposed to just focusing on, you know, the revenue they generate from search, which is really one product when you think about, you know, the overall internet advertising revenue base.
I don't know. I mean, you're not alone. I feel like when the lawsuit came out, you know, I talked to a bunch of tech analysts and they're all like, yeah, it's going to be fine. Yeah, it's all right. It's already priced in. Don't worry about it. So I guess at what point, what would you need to see or read that would actually say, okay, this could actually be a material difference for Google and it could happen in the medium term, in the short term?
Well, so one thing we have seen is with all this going on, their margins have taken a hit. So if you look at Google's gross margin, they have been declining steadily from, you know, about 65% to now they're close to 50%. Partly that has to do with, you know, Google trying to diversify its revenue base. So they are making a big push into cloud. Online video doesn't have the same kind of gross margins as the core search business. And I think from my perspective, once, you know, they have to spend more on acquiring new customers and search becomes a lower gross margin business simply because of all the regulatory requirements that they have to meet, that will start to show up in the profitability numbers. And like I said, they've been trying to offset the gross margin impact through cost cuts. So their operating margins have been steady so far. But once I think if it starts to impact search in a more pervasive way globally, I think that will hurt their margin profiles.
All right, Mandeep, thank you. We love talking to you. Appreciate it. Mandeep Singh of Bloomberg Intelligence.
Coming up on the program, a look at what Barstool Sports may yield on its investment for Penn.
You're going to have to break it down for me first with Barstool stuff. Okay?
I will.
Fine.
We'll
all take right. care of it. You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on some 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Barstool Sports and its new betting app could yield a 45% return on investment by 2023 for Penn. That's assuming the app launches in 10 states. Joining us now, Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Brian Egger. Brian, I've been, you know, ribbing Paul all hour being like, what is it? I don't get it. Explain it to me. So before you get into the details of it, what is it?
So Barstool Sports is a media platform, a media company that basically teamed up with Penn National Gaming, which took a 36% investment in Barstool to not only kind of jointly own the entity, but also to develop a sports betting app. And online sports betting has been very popular and growing at a rising pace recently. So it really is a good opportunity for both Barstool and Penn.
So, Brian, is this, I mean, I do know Barstool. I follow a lot of those guys on social media. They're kind of out there sometimes, but they're entertaining. But they have a lot of users. They have a big audience. It's growing. Do they think that they can really port that into the gaming business?
I think it's because the brand itself has recognition among sports fans. The idea is to combine that with Penn National Gaming-led sports book app development effort, which just launched in Pennsylvania, where the advantage is that Penn has access through its various casino properties to 19 states. So basically it provides an opportunity for Penn launching under the Barstool banner to basically have a sports book app in which they actually get as a company all of the profit participation. And yet, at the same time, they kind of will build over time their ownership interest in Barstool up to 50%. So it's taking that Barstool brand, which heretofore has not been a sportsbook platform, and actually using that branding, that market reach, and that that customer access, along with Penn's access to casino markets, to basically develop a sports betting app that will roll out in new states.
Okay, dumb question. How many states currently legalize sports betting, and are they going to be launching in other states that do that?
So we're at about 24 states right now, and with more rolling out. We're north of 20 states right now. All this happening since the Supreme Court lifted the ban on unrestricted sports betting back in May of 2018.
Brian, who are the players? Just remind us kind of like who the big players are in the sports betting app business, because I know, you know, DraftKings I've heard of, and but Barstool, these Barstool Sports folks, they're new. They're the new play, right?
Right. So they're basically, they have a loyal following, engaged following among sports fans, but they're obviously not known prior to Penn's involvement as being a sports betting application. That's something that Penn is developing. The key rivals in this space are, as you mentioned, DraftKings, FanDuel, which is controlled by Flutter Entertainment, and then another big one is William Hill. And in addition to those, we've got a number of the other gaming companies that are involved in sports betting applications. Those include MGM, through its BetMGM brand, developed in conjunction with GVC Holding, which is a UK-based company, as well as Caesars Online, again, teamed up with William Hill to develop an online sports betting capability. So a number of the large gaming companies have teamed up or partnered in some way with established, very often European-based bookmakers to develop these sports betting apps. And, of course, online betting has been the big opportunity for sports betting in the U.S.
Does it matter what sport you're betting on? Because I heard golf got super popular. No, seriously.
I know.
Popular, you know, particularly during the pandemic when there was the cessation of play by a number of the leagues. But if you look at it in terms of the most popular sport measured by dollars wagered, historically that has been football. And that kind of maybe basketball comes in second. You know, the major popular sporting events are events like the Super Bowl and, of course, the NCAA men's basketball tournament, which has the advantage just as an event of spanning several weeks. So it's not just a single day event.
Hey, Brian, I'm looking at the stock for Penn National Gaming. It's up 127% year to date. Is that being driven in large part by this Barstool Gaming story, or is there something else going on?
I think it partly reflects the optimism about the potential for Barstool to, you know, by our assumptions, initially contribute 4% and eventually contribute something like 6% of Penn's EBITDA, so it should grow in significance. But it also reflects the fact that when you look at regional gaming markets, while revenue is still down, those declines have narrowed, and in many cases we're seeing EBITDA margin improvements. As companies really have cut costs to operate at, in many cases, 50% of full capacity to allow for social distancing. And by cutting those costs and basically setting up more efficient operations, even though revenue is down, they've actually experienced quite a bit of margin expansion.
Well, it's really amazing. I'm just looking at the year-to-date stock price performance. Penn is up 127%. Wynn down 48, Las Vegas Sands down 30, MGM down 37, and Boyd Gaming, another regional name, up 7. So does that – boy, if I'm David Portnoy at Barstool Sports, co-founder, I'm going to the Penn guys and saying, I want a better deal. I am driving your stock. Every other gaming stock is down, and you're up, and I think it's because of me.
Right. Well, of course, they're probably beneficiaries having gotten stock for this as well. But, I mean, I think the reality is that when you look at the larger destination-based gaming companies, you know, the revenues for Macau have been down on the order of 95%. That's principally because of visa restrictions and quarantine requirements that have really prevented that market from slowly recovering. Even Las Vegas, although it's down, maybe not down as sharply as we expected, but it is true that, you know, the local drive to gaming markets have recovered somewhat more quickly than the destination-focused gaming companies like the big Las Vegas resorts, which have the main disadvantage of depending on group travel conventions, which are all air travel dependent. So it is true that regional gaming or local gaming has recovered somewhat more quickly, and the real deficit, I think you could argue, for Las Vegas-based companies is that while leisure-based casino customers are slowly returning after casinos there reopened in Vegas on June 4th, the group and convention business is likely to be quite weak and maybe fairly non-existent until at least mid-2021 when those large groups might possibly start to return.
Brian, thank you. Thank you for putting up my questions. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst Brian Egger.
Well, let's switch gears now to ESG. Green, social, and sustainability bonds surpassed $1.3 trillion in cumulative sales in the third quarter of this year. It's a milestone that proves sustainable debt markets are here to stay. For more, we bring in Bloomberg Intelligence ESG analyst Simone Andrews. Simone, thanks so much for joining us. $1.3 trillion in cumulative sales. What's driving that?
Well, we see that what's driving this is really investor demand is surpassing supply, so there's really an undersupply in ESG debt, as well as we're seeing a lot of movement in the EU. We're seeing that about 325 billion euros are slated to come into social and green bonds starting this year, and we saw that with the EU issuance of its social bond. So it's really driven by investor demand and EU policy.
So yeah, I was wondering about that, how he looked at the social bond sale. Do you feel like, what is the central bank going to have to step in and buy? Are we going to see more of this kind of issued and then the take-up continuing?
Definitely. So with the EU recovery plan, they are actually committing to $100 billion in social bonds as a part of their recovery program. So I see that continuing through 2021. Same with green bonds as a part of the recovery to address pandemic. Part of what's being rolled in is green bonds. So we're going to see more to come, and I think that's just going to further accelerate and strengthen ESG sales going into next year.
All right, Simone, if I'm a company and I'm issuing debt, how do I get designated a green bond?
That's a good question. So the way that you can base what a green bond really is it's about looking at the issuance and towards green projects. So if you're an issuer and you have either an environmental, whether that's renewable energy, green buildings, you can issue a green bond. And then there are certain designations that fit within ICMA standards, and that can also further kind of certify that your green bond is what it is.
Well, who designates me as a green bond issuer? Is it the SEC or is it who?
So there's a number of ways you can be designated as a green bond. One of the ways is through a third-party verification or a second-party opinion. So that's like a company like Sustainalytics or Cercio saying that, hey, we've looked at your bond papers and we've looked at your sustainability reporting, and it looks to be that you're going to be that your issuance is green, and it says it is what it says it is. But there's no SEC determination at this point.
All right, Simone, thanks very much. We really appreciate it. Bloomberg Intelligence ESG analyst Simone Andrews.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.